All right. My name is Craig Yoshoka. I used to actually work in the AMI group. I've just recently left. But one of the last things I was working on was evaluating these new grids from Protochips, which I was lucky enough to get the chance to test out. They call them CryoMesh. And hopefully by the end of this presentation, I'll show you how we think these grids can actually help us collect better data, particularly collect tilted cryo data at better efficiency, but maybe also maybe get to higher resolution. So what are some of the motivations for trying out some of these new grid technologies? Well, as I mentioned, for us, the biggest thing, and me personally, was I was working on automated tilted data collection, and we had a lot of problems collecting usable cryo images. Almost all of them were useless because of this effect called beam-induced motion. And I'll show you in the next slide what I, in detail, mean by beam-induced motion. But there's a couple other reasons why anyone might want to look at new grid technologies, just maybe as a faster, more consistent imaging platform. Maybe they result in better ice, or it's easier to collect data in an automated fashion on them. Maybe if you have a lot of control over how the grids are designed or the pattern that's put on them, you can do something interesting like automating microscope calibration. So here's some examples of what I mean by beam-induced motion. These are all the images I'm going to be showing. I've been like boosted to contrast, so if they look a little funny, I just wanted to make sure they were visible on the projector here. Everyone could see the stuff I was talking about. But so the image on the left is a tilted image taken in ice, and you can see, hopefully, this one's not particularly that bad, but there's certain parts of the image which look blurry and some parts which don't. And in some images, this is really bad, so bad that you might not even be able to pick particles. Or if you were to pick particles, you would be pretty sure that you wouldn't be able to align them accurately. And we know this isn't like some inherent appearance of the sample. If you take an image of the same spot later at the same tilt, even much later, you can see that the second image looks much, much better, which sort of shows that this beam-induced motion effect is something that arises, especially during the initial charging of the sample, initial contact of the electron beam with the sample. Now, I call it sort of a phenomenon because I think it's something that a lot of people have observed, but the reasons that occurs aren't entirely understood. Some people might disagree with me about that. I think most people would agree that the root cause is that the specimen builds up this electric charge when it's irradiated. But whether that electric charge causes mechanical motions that result in blurring as these charges try to equilibrate, or whether there's some kind of a lensing effect, I don't think, or there's both effects, isn't entirely clear. While we're certainly interested in knowing what the causes of this are, we're primarily just more interested in getting rid of it so we can collect better data faster. Here's just some more examples. This one's a little bit better. You can see the blur, irregular image blurring, non-blurred. Here's one that's particularly bad in these areas here, and it looks much better here. So hence CryoMesh. So Protochips, there's been a lot of previous work on trying to reduce the incidence of beam-induced motion in images by working on the grid substrate. A lot of the work is focused on increasing the conductivity of the grid substrate, with the idea if the sample charging is the root cause and you make the grid substrate more conductive, this will help eliminate or ameliorate the effect. Protochips sort of took a two-pronged approach where they were very interested in increasing the conductivity of the grid at all temperatures, especially compared to carbon at low temperatures. But they're also very interested in making a very strong rigid support substrate. And here's a schematic diagram of how the grids are. From here, this looks like just any other grid you might be familiar with that's manufactured, such as C-flats or quantum foils. The differences really are in the materials that are made used to make the grids and how they're made. So they've adopted processes from the semiconductor industry, and they basically used a lot of the same techniques that are used to make computer chips to just basically etch and build these ceramic film membranes out of a single layer. They use silicon carbide that's been doped, and then they take this single support film and then they put it on a support film that has silicon grid bars. And presumably you can imagine they could make those grids to almost any design that's reasonable that you can imagine, which is another interesting aspect. So this whole time we've been getting all kinds of different samples from them. You can see in all different configurations. These are all just taken with a regular, all these grids are just imaged with a regular light microscope. That's the way they look in the light if you hold them at the right angle. These grids are, we're all looking at them from this angle. You can see here that the ceramic film is above the grid bars. If you were to view them from the other side, this outside support ring wouldn't appear color. And indeed, if you can see, if you flip it over, the same grid does show strong color. And so this is the easiest way when you're just in the lab trying to figure out how to use these grids, you can just rock them back and forth, and they'll flash, and you can see which side is which in the light. As I mentioned, here's some. These are basically little glass chips. They're very fragile, but it is possible to handle them, freeze them, get them in the microscope, and image with them. One of the interesting things is they're so rigid and strong, you can see even when chips break off, the rest of the support's still always perfectly flat and even, which is a very nice feature, especially if you're working in tilt. Another really nice thing compared to standard carbon is this support film is so much stronger that the mesh, the square mesh sizes can be made much, much larger. I've seen some of the grids you've gotten only have like 3 squares per grid. So, and the holes can be placed much, much closer together. So you can see, for example, in these ones, these larger meshes are pretty exciting because you can get so many thousands of holes within one square. And then the eye likelihood of getting nice, consistent ice over one square is also higher. So if you hit the jackpot on one of these, you can collect data for days and days, pretty much as much data as you want. So do they actually help with imaging at tilt? Here's just some examples. When we first started doing this, we just sort of doing a qualitative assessment. I mean, we did them on pretty big data sets, but we were just basically looking by eye through the images to see whether there was obvious degradation or there wasn't. So these are equivalent magnifications. And so, you know, I just basically went through all these images and labeled them. Yep, there's beam-induced motion. No, I don't see any here. Here's just some other examples. This is one that's pretty groovy. Here's another one at a slightly higher magnification. These are two higher magnification. So you can see these are pretty good for tilted cryo images. And so the end result of going through all these images for these data sets just by eye was that I found that 5 to 16% of the images when I was just using standard C-flats at tilt turned out to be good. It was probably a little bit lower than that, but I was trying to be as fair as possible between the two data sets versus 48 to 73% for the cryomesh. So this gave us a pretty good indication that these grids were better. There are a lot of things that this analysis is lacking in, presumably most likely because when we were going through, we noticed a lot of things, very subtle differences between the grids. For example, cryomesh not only had less beam-induced motion, it was also less severe when present, or sometimes when it was more severe, it was far more localized to just a small corner of the image, for example. So the rest of the image would still be usable, but I would have still marked it as being bad. So to get at those kind of subtle differences, we decided to do a more quantitative assessment. There hasn't been a lot of work done in trying to evaluate beam-induced motion on single particle images like this, so we had to come up with our own method. This is a debugging image for that method, so it's a little data dense, but I'll talk you through it. Basically, the idea was that we would divide our 4K by 4K images into 1K windows, and for each of those windows, do a power spectrum and try and measure a symmetry in the envelope of that power spectrum. So we're not trying to measure CTF, we're just trying to see if this blurring effect has knocked out high-resolution information in one direction versus another. And so we extract these power spectrums for each of these windows, and we assign a numerical score that reflects how elliptical or how asymmetric that region is. And just to visualize how the beam-induced motion is distributed across the image, you can also do contour plots. And you can see it gets very blurry towards this bottom corner, and it's pretty good towards the top. And we basically, since this was a new thing, I went through tons of these debugging images just to make sure everything made sense. That you can see there's selected cell windows that when it was good, the scores were lower. When there was more beam motion, the scores were higher, and that it scored things basically consistently and so forth. So having done all this, so 49 measurements per image for some data sets contained hundreds of images. You can do histograms, plot those scores as histograms, and overlay the different data sets. And so you have increasing amount of beam-induced motion going towards the right on the x-axis and the percent of images up on the y. And the first thing I'd like to point out are the black lines. The black lines are the zero-degree cryo controls. So these are C-flat grids at 0 degrees. The kinds of data sets we've gotten, you know, 5 angstroms, 9 angstroms, 15 angstrom resolution from those actual data sets. And you can see that they all, it makes sense, they all score very lowly. They form this very nice peak towards the left here. The green line sort of corresponds to where the numerical BIM score, BIM is beam-induced motion, the numerical score corresponds to where it becomes obvious by eye that there's some beam-induced motion there. So we 0-degree data sets look really good. We take the same exact grids and tilt them to 45 or higher degrees, and you can see now the scores are just smeared all the way across. So there's a lot more beam-induced motion. It's all over the place. These images are a lot worse. Whereas the cryomesh grids at tilt, you can see aren't quite as good as 0 degree, but they show much, they show that nice peak at the low measurement areas, which presumably correspond to a lot more of the image area being of higher quality. So that was new. Another way beam-induced motion has been described in the literature is for not necessarily its effects that I'm describing, this irregular image blurring, but how it might affect very high resolution information, that it might actually potentially be one of the main things limiting the resolution attainable in electron microscopy. So Bob Glaser was kind enough to come down and show us this very cool system for looking, trying to get at these subtle differences at high resolution using paraffin crystals. And what's particularly nice about this system is, on a lot of systems when they look at diffraction, you're never quite sure if the crystal didn't diffract well because of beam-induced motion or because the crystal was of poor quality or various other factors. What's very nice about this system is the crystals diffract to very high quality. They form very easily. They diffract to high quality. They're very robust, and they diffract strongly. So you can take a very nice electron diffraction pattern in the microscope and not have damaged the crystal at all, basically. So you can be sure before you do any imaging that the crystal is of high quality. And what we're sort of looking for here is that, you know, all these spots are of reasonably equal intensity, and they're all visible. And so what you do then is take the image and do the power spectrum, and this is correspond to that first ring of spots, 4 angstroms. And this one turns out to be pretty good. You can see that some of these spots are much stronger than others. But typically what I've been led to believe is this is the kind of thing you see more often, where ignore that the CTF is astigmatic. But typically what you see is that some of the spots are much weaker or not even, you won't even be able to see them. So that's what you normally would see. And you can also take, integrate the ratio, basically figure out for each image how strong the ratio of this spot intensity is to the center to get an idea of how good the quality of the image is. And if we do average these all together, we find that the ratio for cryo-mesh turns out to be about 0.0245, and molybdenum grids was what we were comparing again, was 0.006. And I believe Bob told me that 0.02 is what you rarely get, as high as you rarely get. So that's 0.02 is a very good image, sort of, you'd collect a bunch of them, and one of them is 0.02. That's a good image. So you can see that our average is already very good, and sometimes we get higher. I think he was hoping for something closer in the range of 0.1, like something revolutionary. And we haven't got that there, but, you know, this is still very early. This only basically came out of 1 or 2 days of trying this thing out and collecting images. One last thing I'd like to mention about what's interesting about the cryo-mesh, which I alluded to earlier, was that you sometimes do see beam-induced motion in the cryo-mesh. And what's interesting about it is sometimes it's, like I said, more severe, but it's also more localized. And in this case, it's also kind of more predictable, which is something that you're not used to seeing when you're looking at a lot of tilted images. They just look bad. They're all swirling all different directions. And what's interesting here is, like, all these images, which were collected right at this edge here, all had beam-induced motion, and they all had sort of this sort of same over-the-top blurring motion towards the top of the image and looks better towards the bottom, which is one thing that was kind of interesting to me. And we tend to see that areas where the ice looks obviously uneven at low magnification also tends to correlate to areas where imaging is worse. This was a really striking example. Basically, every hole imaged on this square, you can see that the ice in the center is very thin and very dry. It's sort of this film, and there's just this much thicker ring around that. Every single one of these had, like, this very strong beam-induced motion, and I don't know if you can see it. You can see sort of these, like, these lines running down the center and, like, the blurring between them, which is not only, it's really strange because it was very consistent, and it's like nothing we've seen before. So the bottom line is maybe these grids will give us a handle on trying to figure out what is actually going on if we were to look at them more, because it's a more controlled environment. You know, to get at that sort of at the beginning, one of the first things we looked at was trying to compare the variations in ice thickness between cryo-mesh and regular grids. So what I did here was for each image I took before, I then went to very high magnification and etched a channel through the ice at 0 degrees, imaged it at 0 degrees, imaged it at 45 degrees, aligned fiducials like particles and edges in the images, and overlapped them so you can see the variations in ice thickness. And this is very time consuming, so we haven't done so many of these. But one evaluation I made very quickly was that the ice seemed to be more consistent in the cryo-mesh data sets. That is, it was flatter and of more consistent thickness, and that there was, you know, you know, some fairly good correlation with images that had very obvious defects in the variations in the ice and whether or not they exhibited beam-induced motion or not. And here's just some examples from a C-flat, and you can see that there's in some cases there's very large variations in ice thickness. Or in this case, the ice looks fairly even, but it looks a little wavy. These are very sort of qualitative, you know, one-off observations. This would have to be done a lot more. But it's sort of getting at, you know, one of the cool things we can look at with these grids and maybe try and figure out what's going on. So, you know, in conclusion, we don't know yet, or I'm not sure personally, the exact mechanism that causes beam-induced motion. But I think that the quality of the ice is one of the important factors, and maybe the flatness and rigidity of these grids helps a lot by being flat and rigid, but also by leading to more consistent ice thickness and less ice variation. Grids are a little hard to work with. I didn't mention before, but the support layer is pretty thick, so it's hard to get thin ice on them. And they're also a little difficult to focus on. The support layer is paracrystalline. There's no grain. So if you're used to focusing my eye, you have to figure out some other way to focus. But the benefits of them are great. You can, especially if you're trying to collect cryo images at tilt, you can go to a very, very low success rate, you know, around 10% to above 50%, like 75%, which is a huge improvement. So anyway, in conclusion, I'd like to thank people I used to work with, in particular Joel and Erica, which did a lot of help with some of the early stuff with cryomesh. And I think Erica is now looking at further evaluating these grids, for example, using TMV or other systems. Clint and Bridget, of course, and then Bob for coming down and helping us with the paraffin studies. That's it.
Thank you, Craig, for presenting this interesting data, encouraging data on new cryomeshes that could improve the data collection. I probably missed, are these cryomeshes available for people to try them? Or?
Yes, we're trying to get a work. They want to make them available. I think they're still trying to work out. So, for example, I think they'd probably want to try and figure out better some of the issues I mentioned, like they're very hard to work with. Maybe something can be done with the support to make that. Yeah. But I think they're more than willing on a limited basis to let people try them out, especially if they have a specific a problem with beam-induced motion. Yeah, you could probably contact them and see if they'll send you some samples.
Thank you. We have time for several questions.
Express. So in your comparison of the C-flats grids with the cryomesh, mm-hmm. you had some experiments which have tilted where you added an extra layer of carbon.
Yeah, I didn't mention that.
That seemed to make it worse.
Yeah, so... So I didn't know how much how pressed for time I'd be. So you're mentioning these dashed lines here too. So the dashed line.
Go back a couple more slides.
Oh, the
table.
Yeah. Okay.
Which
yeah.
Has additional carbon layer. That's,
yeah.
Yeah. So you know the third line and the sixth line down.
Yeah.
Both are worse than yep. the one
that's the first section. Yeah. And so we redid some of that and. It gets better, it's addressed better in this analysis. So the dashed lines are the equivalents, but with the extra layer of thin carbon. And the reason why we added this is we were doing it over holes, imaging over holes. And we figure it's very common. People say, oh, you add another conductive layer, maybe you'll improve it, or you'll have some support over the holes. So we tried it to try and get better results. And what we actually saw that it sort of helped in this analysis for the C-flats, because you can see that whereas before it sort of smeared everywhere, now you start getting this peak that's dragged towards the left. But that peak's still in the area where there's still very noticeable beam-induced motion. And in the case of cryomesh, you can see it sort of dragged that peak towards the right and sort of made the images worse. And initially, this was very surprising. I think one of the reasons we went into analyzing variations in ice thickness was that one of the things we saw was that ice thickness was a lot more variable on these grids, where we had the extra layer of thin carbon. And that was sort of a clue that was maybe a first place to start looking. Yeah.
And then can I ask, was the paraffin crystals also on a thin film of carbon?
Yes. Yeah.
Some of the grids have a very large mesh. Did they show more beam-induced movement than the small meshes?
I can't say that I noticed any difference than that in that respect. Now, I just like the larger meshes. They tend to, in my experience, they tended to have more consistent ice, freeze a little bit better, thinner ice, and like easily get one good square and collect data for the rest, as much data as you want, yeah.
Okay, any more questions?
Yes.
Oh, the grid bars are quite thick, but in the larger meshes, they're not a problem at all. Like, so the support's so nice, you can make the mesh enormous, and basically the grid bars won't intrude. I think they're 35 microns thick. And then we measured the actual support layer, which I mentioned was kind of thick. We got anywhere from between 700 to 1,200 angstroms thickness. So that makes it a little harder to get thin ice. But as you can see, it's still possible. And actually, going back to the image of the grids directly, I think part of the reason their colors, they look different colors, is related to how thick they are. Yeah.
How would they fare mounted?
So I think they're easier to mount in that. You mean it has a C-clips?
Yeah,
I think that's easier. What's really bad are the kinds of where you have the screw into place kind of clip rings, because you're screwing that in. Not the screw into place one. Sorry, the ones where you push hard to get them to click. That'll like just blow the grid up every time. The screw into place kinds or the C clips where you can kind of like gently deposit it and then release it. I've had much better luck with them. So I've imaged cryomesh on the Polara, and I had a much easier time getting them into those cartridges, in my hands at least.